everyone's had a very good week, a nice Sabbath here. This time of year is just absolutely fantastic. You know, with the holy days, we've still got the little holy day, you know, high going on, and then the weather turning nice. So it's just been a great time of year. Well, brethren, every year at the beginning of the school year, the school has what they call it's a parent-teacher night. And it's an opportunity for us parents to go, and when our kids have their classes, we get to go around and meet all their teachers and find out the curriculum and what they're going to do throughout the year. It's kind of a way for us parents to know which classes we can actually help our kids do the homework in and which ones we can't. And so we always take that opportunity to go and do this. And this past year, we were going around in Mikla's school, and we got to her Honors American Lit class. And so we're sitting here in this Honors American Lit, and the teacher starts going through the curriculum, what they're going to teach throughout the year. And so she starts off saying, well, all the kids, we're going to have the kids read the Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. I'm thinking, I could do that. You know, throughout the school year, I could get that read. And she goes, and The Great Gatsby, and Catcher in the Rye, and Othello, Secret Life of Bees, The Crucible, Scarlet Letter, and she kept going on and on and on. And I'm sitting there kind of looking at her and kind of just a bewilderment, and Colette leans over to me and she goes, you'd never pass this class. And she was absolutely right. I would have never passed the class. For one, I don't like to read, and two, I'm just not that smart to understand what they're saying when you're reading those anyway. You know, they sit there and they read these novels, and the teacher asks, you know, what was the author thinking? You know, what kind of mood was he in when he was writing this? And I'm like, I don't know. Apparently he was thinking about writing a long-winded, confusing novel. You know, I don't know what he was thinking. And so it was something that literature, whether it's American lit, English lit, doesn't matter what kind it is, it's something I was always challenged with. It just never made me, I'm right-brained. Is that the opposite of whatever people don't understand that is? But I just really had a hard time with literature like that. And so this afternoon here, I'm going to step out on faith. We're going to look at some biblical literature. And I say that because it is literature. It's God-inspired literature. It's literature that it's depressing, but at the same time, it's uplifting. It's tragic, but at the same time, it's triumphant. It's historic, but yet it's prophetic. It's poetic, yet it's non-poetic. It's tearful, yet it's joyful. And I'm referring to the God-inspired literature of the Book of Lamentations. This is something that I hadn't really studied into, and it's not a book that we refer to very often, not one we go into. It's not very pleasant reading. There's some very, very unpleasant things in the Book of Lamentations. However, there are some very powerful lessons. There's some very powerful, worthwhile lessons in this book for us today. So this afternoon, I'd like to focus on lessons of the Book of Lamentations. Or you could call this, you know, the Lessons of Lamentations. It's LOL. So, and I think everyone knows what LOL means. Actually, I don't think everyone does, because, you know, in the texting and tweeting world, you type, someone sends you something funny, you reply back, LOL, you know, laugh out loud. Yeah, that made me laugh. Mikla told us, she came home from school one day, and she said one of her friend's moms had, her aunt had passed away. And so this mom had sent all of her family members a text, said, Aunt Trudy had just passed away, LOL, exclamation point. And the family was they couldn't believe how insensitive she was. She actually thought it meant lots of love, not laugh out loud. So forget all that. We're talking about Lessons of Lamentations this morning. That's what LOL means. Let's turn over to Lamentations chapter 1. Since it's a book we don't refer to very often, it's after Jeremiah and before Ezekiel. And so we're going to look at the Lamentations here. First of all, a little bit of background. The author of Lamentations typically is credited to the prophet Jeremiah. There are some scholars that dispute this and for some various reasons, but I tend to believe that Jeremiah was the writer of this book. Lamentations describes the death of what was at that time a once great city, the city of Jerusalem. The Babylonian armies have come in and they've completely destroyed Jerusalem, the temple. And this is in 586 BC, the first temple. And Jeremiah writes this poem, this literature, you know, pouring out his emotions of the events of the past, of the present, and of the future. Lamentations is broken down into five chapters. Each one of these chapters is its own poem in itself. The chapters 1, 2, 4, and 5 are all 22 verses long. Chapter 3 is 66 verses long. And this was written, as I mentioned, in a poem in an alphabetical fashion or its acrostic fashion. And so the beginning of each letter in verse 1 is the beginning of the Hebrew alphabet. There's 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And so each verse is the beginning of the Hebrew alphabet as they go through. And then in chapter 3 is actually the first three verses are the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The next three are the next three. And so in Hebrew, the original writing of this, it's actually written in a very poetic format. And it's very interesting because the book of Lamentations here, the first two chapters, kind of builds up to the top point, really, in chapter 3. Then it kind of descends back down in a typical poetic fashion. Why does he use poetry? Why does God use poetry sometimes to teach us? Lots of times when we communicate with one another, we communicate in a very logical fashion. I want to talk to you, you talk to me, and so it comes to our minds where we understand one another. But poetry is different. With poetry, it gets to our emotions. It gets to our heart. There's a different sense when you're reading poetry, and so it's quite a bit different than just communicating. So with that, we'll look to start off here with just a few verses to get a feel for the book and a feel for the poetry, or at least as it's translated in English. I think the English translation probably takes quite a bit away from this versus the original Hebrew. But let's start off here with Lamentations 1 and in verse 6. And from the daughter of Zion, all her splendor has departed. Her princes have become like deer. People just wandering around, kind of a deer in the headlights type of look, kind of a glazed look. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture, that flee without strength before the pursuer. Basically, these are describing this deer running around the field, no one pursuing them, just running around, kind of not knowing what's going on. Verse 16. For these things I weep. My eye overflows with water because the Comforter, who should restore my life, is far from me. My children are desolate because the enemy prevailed. In verse 20. See, O Eternal, that I am in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned within me, for I have been very rebellious. Outside, the sword bereaves. At home is like death. Jeremiah is very upset. He's extremely upset. He's crying. He's pouring out his emotions as he writes this poem, as he writes this literature, this God-inspired literature. He has no place to go. He says there's death at his home. He has no home. And this is meant to reach the heart. It's not meant in a logical sense, but this is very emotional and meant to actually reach the heart. The Orthodox Jews normally read the Book of Lamentations. I believe it's the ninth day of the fifth month, if I got that right. But it corresponds to about the July-August time frame. They have certain books they read certain times of the year. And the Book of Lamentations is read then, and it's to commemorate the destruction of the temples. Because both temples, the first one in 586 BC and the second in 7 AD, were destroyed in the same day, just, 600 and odd years apart, whatever it is. So the Orthodox Jews read the Book of Lamentations as a commemoration for the destruction of the temples at that time. Lamentations is a book of woe and destruction, but it's also a prophetic book. It was written... for the time, it was prophetic for the time it was written, but it's also prophetic for us today, for the time ahead of us. It pictures the time of the Great Tribulation. In order to add some context to the events of Lamentations, let's first understand what's taken place to get up to this point. And so let's go back to 2 Chronicles in chapter 35. If you want to keep your place in Lamentations, we will be coming back there. The Second Chronicles chapter 35. Here the occasion is the death and funeral of King Josiah. Jeremiah, possibly spoke Lamentations at King Josiah's funeral. Can't say that for sure, but it's kind of the indication. But let's look at 2 Chronicles 35 and in verse 23. See what happened here. And the archers shot King Josiah. And the king said to his servants, "Take me away, for I am severely wounded." His servants therefore took him out of that chariot, put him into a second chariot that he had. They brought him to Jerusalem. So he died and was buried in one of the tombs of his fathers. All of Judea and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. Now, Josiah was a very well-respected king. He'd done a lot of good things for the nation. And they mourned for Josiah, but they also mourned for themselves. Why did they mourn for themselves? We'll see that down a little bit later, why they were mourning for themselves. Verse 25. Jeremiah also lamented for Josiah. And to this day, all the singing men and the singing women speak of Josiah in their lamentations. They make it a custom in Israel, and indeed, they are written in the laments. Jeremiah is lamenting the death of Josiah, but he's also looking ahead. It's more than Josiah's involvement in the lamentations here. But why would the people be mourning for themselves? Let's go back here in chapter 34. In 2 Chronicles 34, we're going to pick it up in verse 1. We'll see a little bit more as to why the mourning was just more than just for their king. The people at this time had one of the rare things that few people have. They knew where their place was in history. They knew what was going to happen, what was going to occur. And they knew what was going to happen next wasn't going to be pleasant. The book of Lamentations is not pleasant, it's not pretty, it's not nice reading, but it has some very, very powerful lessons, and that's really what I want to take away from this. Let's go back here and see why they were mourning. We're going to read 2 Chronicles 34, starting in verse 1. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. He did what was right in the sight of the Eternal, and walked in the ways of his father David. He did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. He was a really good king. There were some good kings and there were some bad kings. Josiah was one of the good guys. He was following God. Verse 3. For in the 8th year of his reign, when he was still young, so he'd be 16 at this time, a 16-year-old king, and think of the maturity here. For the 8th year of his reign, while he was still young, he began to seek God, seek the God of his father David. In the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places, the wooden images, the carved images, and the molded images. Here's a 20-year-old king, and he's cleaning up the nation. He's 16 years old, he's seeking God, he's going back, he's cleaning up the nation. The nation was very steep into pagan worship at this time. And here's a very, very young king gets to the throne and says, "You know what? It's time to clean up. We're going to clean it up and get back to where we should be." Verse 4. They broke down the altars of the Baals in his presence, and the incense altars which were above them he cut down, and the wooden images, the carved images, and the molded images he broke into pieces, and made dust of them and scattered them on the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. You could say he was cleaning house at this point. He was trying to get things straight. Skip down to verse 8. Now in the 18th year of his reign, when he had purged the land and the temple. And think about this. At the 18th year of his reign, he was 8 years old when he was taking the throne. So what's that, 24 years old at this point? He started cleaning up the kingdom when he's in the 20th year. So it took four, if my math is right, it took 4 years to get it cleaned up. It gives you an indication of exactly how steep they were into pagan, into Baal worship throughout the nation of Judah there in Jerusalem. It takes 4 years to tear down everything and really get it cleaned up. That's how steep they were into this pagan worship. And so when he had purged the land and the temple, he sent Shaphan, the son of Azalea, another guy, the governor of the city, and Joah, the son of Joaz, the recorder, to repair the house of the Eternal, his God. When they had come to Hilkiah, the high priest, they delivered the money that was brought into the house of God, which the Levites had kept who kept the doors, and gathered from the hand of Messiah and Ephraim, from all the remnants of Israel, from all Judah and Benjamin, and which they had brought back to Jerusalem. Then they put it into the hand of the workmen who had oversight of the house of the Eternal, and they gave it to the workmen and worked in the house of the Eternal to repair and restore the house. So they were tearing down all these pagan statues, the worship, the idols, and then they're restoring now the temple. He's bringing money in from the whole nation, getting everybody involved, and they're restoring the temple, trying to get back to the right worship that they had strayed from at this point. Verse 14. Now when they brought them out the money that was brought into the house of the Eternal, Hilkiah the high priest found the book of the law of the Lord given by Moses. Then Hilkiah answered and said to Shaphan the scribe, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Eternal. And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan. So Shaphan carried the book to the king, bringing the king word, saying, all that was commanded of your servants, they are doing. You know, they're tearing down the idols, getting rid of the pagan worship. They're building the temple. They're getting it cleaned up, ready for the right and proper worship. They're doing all these things, verse 17. And they have gathered the money that was found in the house of the Eternal and have delivered it into the hand of the overseers and the workmen. Then Shaphan the scribe told the king, saying, Hilkiah the priest has given me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. Then it happened, when the king heard the words of the law, he tore his clothes. He knew they were in trouble. It was a very repentant attitude. But he knew when he heard the law and what he saw in his nation, it wasn't the same. And he knew that they were in trouble. Then the king commanded Hilkiah, Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, Abdon, the son of Micah, Shaphan the scribe, and Uzziah, the servant of the king, say, you know, why doesn't God just say he commanded all these dudes to come together? He knows I can't pronounce these. I try anyway. That's just a small side point. Anyways, verse 21, 2 Chronicles 34, verse 21. Go inquire of the Eternal for me and for those who are left in Israel and Judah concerning the words of the book that is found. For great is the wrath of the Eternal that is poured out on us, because our fathers have not kept the word of the Eternal. Do according to all that is written in this book. So Hilkiah and those the king had appointed went to Huldah, the prophetess, etc., you know, keeper of the wardrobe. And they spoke to her to that effect. And she answered them, thus says the Lord God of Israel, tell the man who sent you to me, thus says the Eternal, behold, I will bring calamity on this place and on its inhabitants, all the curses that are written in the book which they have read before the king. And so she's telling them what's going to happen here. All the curses that are written in the book which they have read before the king of Judah, because they have forsaken me and burned incense to other gods, that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore my wrath will be poured out on this place and not be quenched. But as for the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of the Eternal, in this manner you shall speak to him. Thus says the Eternal God of Israel concerning the words which you have heard. Because your heart was tender, and you humbled yourself before God when you heard his words against this place and against its inhabitants, and you humbled yourself before me, and you tore your clothes and wept before me, I also have heard you, says the Eternal. Surely I will gather you to your fathers, and you shall be gathered to your grave in peace. And your eyes shall not see the calamity which I will bring on this place and its inhabitants. So they brought word back to the king. And so why were the people mourning for themselves at this point? You know, God tells them, when Josiah is dead buried with his fathers, put away, then it's going to happen. And they knew this. They knew this. I mean, I think I would have been keeping Josiah away from the battle line. you'd want to keep him alive. But God says, because of his attitude, he's going to die in peace. And then when that's done, we're going to clean house. We're going to get things right. And so the people had been warned. They were told what was going to happen. God made it clear he was going to take down the nation of Judah because of their sins, because of their rebellion. God even tells them the timing. He tells them it's going to be after Josiah's death. And so, as I mentioned, these are some of the few people in history that knew their place in history. They knew what was going to happen. You know, once King Josiah died, it wasn't going to be good for them. Well, this provides some background why the Book of Lamentations, you know, why the punishment. They had forsaken God. They had forsaken his ways. You know, they didn't do what they were instructed to do. When they left Egypt, God made clear the instructions to his children of Israel. And time again, they went back into pagan worship. Time and time again. And he kept trying to bring them back. And they would go back into pagan worship. And he would try to bring them back. And they hadn't learned the lesson. Now let's go back to Lamentations 1. I want to spend a little time at first just to give you that background to put you in a sense as to what the people would have been thinking and feeling at this time, including the prophet Jeremiah. You know, Lamentations was a prophecy for their time. You know, they knew what was coming. And it's also a prophecy for us because it talks about the time of the events in the future, what is still lies ahead of us. You know, it's a picture of the great tribulation and how bad things will get. So it's a prophecy then, and it's a prophecy now. So let's look at some of the lessons here in Lamentations. In chapter 1, Jeremiah starts off, and it's a very serious situation. There's a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of punishment. It's just very, very dire situations here. Lamentations 1 and verse 1. And remember, as you're reading this, like I said, the English translation kind of takes away, I'm sure, from what the Hebrew would be in the poetic formats. But as we read this, you can think about this and how Jeremiah is going in a poetic format so it gets to our hearts and our emotions and we truly understand what he was going through at this time also. Verse 1. How lonely sits the city, he's talking about Jerusalem. How lonely sits Jerusalem that was full of people. How like a widow is she, who was great among the nations. The princess among the province has become the slave. She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Brethren, as I mentioned, this is not pleasant reading. But it's something that we need to read. We need to understand. It doesn't take much explanation, so I won't stop in some places. I'll just go on through. But we need to understand the background. We need to understand the prophetic implications here. Verse 3. Judah has gone into captivity, under affliction and hard servitude. She dwells among nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in dire straits, you know, in terrible conditions, in deplorable conditions. The roads to Zion mourn because no one comes to the set feasts. Brethren, it's something we always need to remember. If we ever have a question, do we need to ever be at the feast? Yeah, we do. We absolutely do. We can't stray from God's feast. We can't stray from his holy days. Just as his people had done here. It says no one has come into the feast, to God's appointed feast. Talking about in Jerusalem here. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted. And she is in bitterness. You know, this sets the tone here, the beginning of this poem, of this literature, of this inspired, God-inspired book. Set the tone, but there's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of misery. There's a lot of pain. Then and to come. You know, what was the reason for the pain is mentioned in 2 Chronicles, verse 5. Her adversaries have become the master. Her enemies prosper. For the Lord has afflicted her because of the magnitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. Well, the reason for a lot of the pain is because of their own sin and rebellion. Their own sin and rebellion is the reason. Verse 8. Jerusalem has sinned gravely. Therefore, she has become vile. What was the city of God, the holy city, has become now vile. It's become a city of filth, as Jeremiah describes it here. Verse 14. The yoke of my transgression was bound. They are woven together by the hands and thrust upon my neck. You know, God took the sins of the people. He put them together and hung them around their neck. He said, your sins, you wear them. Verse 18. The Eternal is righteous, for I rebelled against His commandment. So even Jeremiah is lamenting, knowing that he had not done exactly as he should have also. You know, these are just some of the verses explaining the reason for the punishment and the reason for the pain. As I mentioned, they had forsaken God. They had forsaken what He had told them when they left Egypt, what He had told them back in Deuteronomy, and specifically in Deuteronomy 28 in the blessings and cursings chapter. God tells you, you do this, you'll be blessed. You don't do this, you'll be cursed. It was very, very clear. And He laid it out for His children, but yet they still forgot. When you compare Deuteronomy 28 and the book of Lamentations, there's about 15 or so different passages that are very much parallels, one to the other. One that He told them back then, one that Jeremiah talks about that's happening right then and will happen in the future. So let's look at just a couple of these. I don't have time to get through all 15. But there's a few of them here. And if you look in Lamentations 1, in the beginning of verse 5, we already read this, but the beginning of verse 5, it says, her adversaries have become the master. Now keep your place there, and let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 28. I want to just show you a few of these, where God had told His children what would happen. He told them back in Deuteronomy, and then here in Lamentations you can see it happening. But Deuteronomy 28 and verse 44. So in Lamentations 1 verse 5 it says, her adversaries have become the master. Back in Deuteronomy 28 verse 44, God says, He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head and you shall be the tail. It's a master-slave relationship here He's describing. In Lamentations, they tell you exactly what happened. Keep your finger there in Deuteronomy. Let's go back to Lamentations, and we're going to play a little finger twister here. Some of these fingers I can get you in your Bible. But we'll go back to Lamentations and actually read the latter part of verse 5. Lamentations 1 and verse 5. And Jeremiah says, her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. Back in Deuteronomy 28, look at verse 32. So Lamentations says, her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. Deuteronomy 28, verse 32. Your sons and your daughters shall be given to another people. They'll be given into captivity. Their life will not be their own. It's one thing to read this and see these comparisons, but it's another thing to be sitting there as Jeremiah is writing this, living through this, knowing what he's talking about is happening right then, and it's also something that's going to happen in the future. Let's go back, look at one more here. In Lamentations 2. And I will say this is one of the most difficult scriptures that you can read. It's one of the most disturbing prophecies, in my opinion, in the Bible. And it's something that's happened in the past, and unfortunately it's something that will happen in the future. Look at Lamentations 2 and verse 20. Jeremiah writes here, see, O Eternal, and consider, to whom have you done this? Should the women eat their offspring, the children who they have cuddled? It doesn't get much more disturbing than that. This is one of the most horrid and wretched things, and you can imagine Jeremiah writing this, because he's writing what he's seeing, and he's also writing what he knows is going to happen even at a later future time. And God had warned about that. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 28 and verse 53. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 53. It says here, "You shall eat the fruit of your own body, the flesh of your sons and your daughters, whom the eternal your God has given you, in the siege, in desperate straits, in which your enemy will distress you. The sensitive and very refined men among you will be hostile towards his brother, towards his wife, the wife of his bosom, and toward the rest of his children, whom he leaves behind, so that he will not give any of them the flesh of his children, whom he will eat, because he has nothing left in the siege, in desperate straits in which your enemy shall distress you at all of your gates." And you could read, it goes on a little further. And it's, frankly, it's too disturbing to read. And it's something God warned him about. And then here, Jeremiah is telling him, you know what? He sees it. It's happening. And he also says it's going to happen in the future. Let's go back to Lamentations 1. As I mentioned, this was prophetic at the time. And it's also prophetic for us now, the time of the Great Tribulation. Let's look at verse 17. "Zion spreads out her hands, but no one comforts her. The Eternal has commanded concerning Jacob." And it's interesting that Jeremiah mentions Jacob right here. You know, why does he mention Jacob? Well, Jeremiah lived in Jerusalem, which was part of Judea. Jacob, or Israel, you know, was up in the north and had already been into captivity over 100 years before this was written. So this is pointing to a future Israel, a future time. "The Eternal has commanded concerning Jacob that those around him become his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them." And if you go down to Lamentations 2 and verse 2, you see some similar wording. And let's look at that. 2 verse 2. "The Lord is swallowed up and has not pitied all the dwelling places of Jacob." You know, Jacob's mentioned here again, not Jerusalem, not Judah, but Jacob. "He has thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughters of Judah. He has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom and its princes. He has cut off in fierce anger every horn of Israel." Another reference to Israel here, not Jerusalem, not Judah. This points to a future time. It points to the time of a great tribulation, time of suffering, of pain, of starvation, a time of what we read about that Jeremiah poured his heart out about in the book of Lamentations. In Lamentations chapter 2, Jeremiah talks about God's anger because of his people. You know, it's a time of punishment, but it's punishment with a purpose. God doesn't punish just to punish. He never does that. There's a reason for his purpose. And the reason is the result, what ends in a good thing. Brethren, one thing that God looks at as he's punishing people, he's looking at the end result. Lots of times, I know myself, and I'm sure everyone's in here, we look at the here and now. We're looking at what's happening in our lives right now. And God has the wisdom, the knowledge, he knows his plan, and he's looking at the end result. So if there's punishment, if there's pain and there's suffering, you know what? God's looking at the end result, and he knows the absolute best way for us to get there. Let's look at Lamentations 2 and verse 1. "How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel and did not remember his footstool in the day of his anger." God is focused on the end result. He knows how to get the best results, the best way to get there. And so he's not looking at the here and now. He's looking at the end result. Well, I would ask you to, if you feel up to it, go back and read this whole book. doesn't take very long. There's not that many verses. But just read it and think about the events that have happened back then. And keep in mind, this is also a prophetic book talking about events yet to happen. Let's go on here to Lamentations chapter 3. As I mentioned, it's building up to a crescendo, a high point. In Lamentations 3, there's more pain, there's more sorrow, there's more suffering. We're going to start here in verse 19. Remember my afflictions in roaming, the wormwood and the gall. He's telling God, remember all my problems. Don't forget my problems. Verse 20. My soul still remembers and sinks within me. Jeremiah has problems, and he's thinking about it, just as you and I have problems, as we all have problems. Sometimes we feel that the world is closing in around us, and we can't handle it anymore. But notice how Jeremiah changes his outlook here. The things he's witnessing, things he's prophesying about are tragic, and he's thinking about his own self. And then all of a sudden, he changes his outlook. This is something that we can keep in mind too. Verse 21. This I recall to my mind, therefore I have hope. What has he remembered in this time of trouble? What all of a sudden has given him hope? Well, he's remembered that God was with him in the past. Something that we should always remember. God's been with us in the past. God is with him now. And God's with us now. And God will be with us in the future. He finally remembers this. And it dawns on him. He suffered just as you and I suffer. But with God, we're not alone, because he is with us. And he's looking at the end result. He's looking at the good, the positive, that what's really going to come out of all this. Verse 22. Through the eternal's mercies, we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. So he turns around, he's getting very depressed, and all of a sudden now he turns around and he's praising God. He got his mind off of himself, and he got his mind on God, knowing God knows best, and this is all done for a purpose and a reason far greater than he could even understand. We may have troubles, but God will see us through them. It's his promise. It's something that we should always remember. Verse 24. The eternal is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I hope in him. The eternal is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. Brethren, remember this. If you're going through a trial, as you go through trials, remember this. God is going to be with you. But we must have patience. We can't force God's hand. We can't force him to do things, even though that may be what we want. That may be what we want to happen. But he knows best, and he's looking at a much, much greater plan than you or I can even fathom. And he knows what's best. We need to do our part and pray and seek God's will. And then we need to wait on him. Wait on him, and he is going to be with us. Verse 26. It is good that one should hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the eternal. It is good for a man to bear the yoke of his youth. Let him sit alone and keep silent. Verse 31. For the eternal will not cast off forever. Though he causes grief, yet he will show compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. For he does not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men. God doesn't punish just to punish. He's looking at the end result. He's looking at a very, very positive end result. Let's skip over here to Lamentations 4. Actually, I'm not going to read Lamentations 4 just due to time. But it talks about the conditions of the siege. The punishment of Jerusalem and Judah. It talks about more starvation, people lying in the streets, destruction of the temple, and the deplorable acts that occurred during the siege when the Babylonians came in. And it was just a terrible, terrible situation. We're going to go on to chapter 5, start in verse 7. And Jeremiah is lamenting still yet about more problems and more tragedies. We'll pick it up here, 5 verse 7. Our fathers sinned and are no more, but we bear their iniquities. But we also bear our own iniquities. We bear our own sins, the results of those. Verse 16. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. You know, what does God say about losing our crown? It's Revelation 3:11. I think he tells us to hold on to it. Hold fast to it. Don't let anybody take it. Don't lose it. Jeremiah is saying, the crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. Because of this, our heart is faint. Because of these things, our eyes grow dim. Because of Mount Zion, which is desolate, with foxes walking about on it. You, O Eternal, remain forever, your throne from generation to generation. Why do you forget us and forsake us for so long a time? Brethren, we've all been in lengthy trials. Sometimes they go on for years. Why do trials go on so long? Well, we read earlier that God says it doesn't matter. We have to, you know, pray to God. We got to seek His will, and we got to sit back and be patient. Sit back quietly and be patient. Continue to serve God, and with God's Spirit, we are going to make it through it. What was one of the takeaways that Mr. Ashley talked about in the Bible study? When he said this, I wrote it down because I thought it tied right in here. One of the takeaways was, he said, being in God's plan doesn't make for an easy life. You know, how true is that? Being in God's plan doesn't make for an easy life. You know what it does make for? It makes for a great future. Something that God has His eye on what is the ultimately going to end up. Where is the ultimate goal? That's something that God keeps His eye on. And it's something that we need to keep our eye on also. Verse 21. Turn us back to You, O Eternal, and we will be restored. Renew our days as of old. You know, ask God to bring us through these trials as His will. Ask Him to bring us through. And then watch Him work. Watch Him work. Verse 22. Lest You have utterly rejected us, and we are very angry with us. When I first read that, it sounded like just a really harsh ending to the book. But what Jeremiah is saying, you know, as a people, you know, we're asking You to remember Your promises. You know, unless You're really angry and at us forever, but remember Your promises to us that You are going to, you know, carry us through. Brethren, there are many lessons throughout this book. And like I said, I would encourage you to go back and to read it with that context in mind as to the, what was happening at the time this was written. Now I'm just going to recap here just a few that I'd like us to think about. Just a few of the lessons, and there are many, many more lessons than just this. But one of the lessons is that sin causes problems. Sin causes problems. There's absolutely no way around it. You know, the pleasures of sin are temporary. They're very quick, but the consequences last a long time. It's things that you'll carry through a lifetime. If you remember what we read, let's look at Lamentations 1 and verse 9. We already read it, but let's go back here and look at this again. Lamentations 1, verse 9. Her uncleanness is in her skirts. She did not consider her destiny. The people were not looking ahead. They were not looking at the end goal. They were looking at what they wanted. They were looking at the sin that maybe looked appealing at the time, looked so nice and so easy. They weren't thinking about their responsibility. They weren't thinking about the consequences that this had in their lives. There are consequences for our actions, and it will catch up with us. The bill will finally arrive. Sometime, someplace, it's going to arrive. Another lesson in this book that I want us to remember is the tribulation is coming. The tribulation is coming, plain and simple. They went through their own tribulation. If you read this throughout the book, But a greater one is even coming than what we can read here, than what Jeremiah weeps about and pours out his heart through this whole book. There's a greater one coming. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 24. Jesus Christ taught about the signs of the time and the end of the age. And he's basically talking about the first four seals of the book of Revelation. But here in verse 9, Matthew 24, verse 9, talks about the fifth seal. So let's pick it up there. Matthew 24, verse 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. Verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, when you see this, brethren, when we see this, it's time to take action. It's not time to put our head in the sand. It's not time to go hiding. It's time to take action. Verse 16. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. Verse 19. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies for in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. Then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. If we think about this as we go back and read the book of Lamentations, think about this. It says it's going to be worse than whatever has been seen. And honestly, what's described in Lamentations is frankly just dreadful. I don't know another word to describe it. It's horrendous conditions. And Jesus Christ saying, it's going to be worse. It's going to be worse. You haven't seen anything yet. Verse 22. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Mankind would utterly destroy mankind. Only due to God's mercy, God's love, He's not going to allow this. It's the only reason He's not going to allow this is because of His mercy, because of His love, not because of what anyone else has done. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 12. There's actually a lot of bad news we've talked about. There's also some good news in all of this. Revelation 12, we'll start in verse 10. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of His Christ have come. For the accuser of the brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives to death. And it's talking about a martyrdom here, about the fifth seal, the martyrdom of God's people. In verse 12, therefore rejoice, O heaven, and you will dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child, persecuted the church. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. There's a group here that he's talking about that's going to be protected from the horrors that we have described in Lamentations, and the horrors that are going to be one step or two steps or five steps worse than that. Verse 16. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of its mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring the commandments of God and have the testimonies of Jesus Christ. There's two groups here talking about. You know, one's going to be protected and one isn't. There's a lot of speculation. Who's in one group? Who's in the other? I can't say I can give you an answer. There's a lot of different thoughts on that as to why is God going to protect some and why is He going to not protect some. The point is, tribulation is coming. Another lesson that we can pull from the book of Lamentations. We do know the timing of our place in history. Just as Jeremiah was writing, when King Josiah died, the people at that time knew their place in history. They knew what was coming. God said it, and it was going to happen. So in a general sense, we know our timing also. We know it because God's feast, His holy day plan, is laid out for us and has given us that beautiful plan that He has came up with. He's put in action, and that's happening. He's laid out His plan for us. And so we're among a rare group of people that actually know our place in history, know where we're at. We don't know the exact timing, but we do know the end result. We do know where it's going to end. Brethren, just as sure as Judah was destroyed following the death of King Josiah, you know, God said it would happen, and it happened. You know, sin brings disastrous results. God promises a wonderful future beyond all the problems, beyond all the things we may see here and now in our lives. Things that when our world is closing in around us and we have our mind focused on the short term, on ourselves, God has something much more wonderful in stake for us. And so He's promised a wonderful future beyond all the problems, beyond all the pain, beyond all the suffering. We know what lies ahead. We know what the end of the story is. And thankfully, I can say it's a good ending.